We're going to start the meeting, even though we don't have a quorum, because we have a lot of people signed up to testify, and 11:30. We're going to 11:30 today. We'll have more people testify tomorrow, and obviously on the governor's proposed budget. And we're going to start, and we would hope that everybody would try to limit their remarks to 3 minutes, so we can get as many people as possible to get testified today and tomorrow. First of all, we have John Barker from Merrick Inc. He's here. Yep. Yep. Oh, welcome to the. Oops.
Forgot my testimony.
I'll just make it up.
Get more money.
That was a nice sharp one.
And when you start, if you would give your name, that's for the tape so that they can recognize when they record the stuff we've talked. So welcome to the committee, Mr. Barker.
Representative Huntley and members of the committee, good morning. My name is John Wayne Barker, and I'm testifying on behalf of MNDACA. I'm the executive director of Merrick Inc., an adult day services, day training and rehabilitation, and supported employment services provider located in Vadnais Heights, serving nearly 375 adults with intellectual or developmental disabilities, a number of which are constituents of Representatives Dean, Fisher, Loeffler, and Morin. In regards to the governor's budget, my purpose this morning is to convey the general concerns of nonprofits that, on behalf of the state, provide desired and mandated services to over 16,000 citizens with disabilities. It is very likely that this committee will take testimony and vote on the following legislation during 2013. A family out-of-pocket fee, which is a provision inadvertently applied to Medicaid providers during harried budget negotiations that should be repealed. A six-month reduction of 1.67% and a one-month payment shift effective July 1st of this year because CMS did not approve early implementation of the state's NF level of care. With a projected $100 million savings in health and human service spending, it would be unnecessarily punitive to impose this cut on your provider partners, and isn't a payment shift something we regret having done to our public schools. An increase in provider licensing fees. As proposed, Merrick's licensing fees will go from $5,050 to $19,750 annually, an increase of 391%, without any mechanism for us to generate offsetting reimbursement. Besides taking dollars away from client services, isn't applying an exorbitant fee against Medicaid providers a bit like taxing tax dollars? Implementation of a new disability waiver rate system. Even now, we are still working with DHS in an effort to finalize a rate framework and values that will begin the process of complying with CMS requirements over the next few years. This has been a difficult and time-consuming process for both DHS and providers that hopefully will result in consensus legislation this session. Cost of living adjustment. Perhaps the most common issue among all long-term care providers is the absolute need for a real COLA this session. Speaking specifically for my provider group, since 2009, we have endured rate cuts of 3.58%, while inflation is well over 6%, resulting in a gap of at least 10%. DHS is proposing a pay-for-performance initiative that is unspecified in 2 years down the road. For the past 4 years, long-term care providers and the people we serve have taken cuts so the state could balance its budget. And now it is time to adequately fund services that define the quality of life for our most vulnerable citizens and their families. In closing, as a provider group, we are deeply disappointed that the governor's budget did not include funding that would repeal the family out-of-pocket fee and the 1.6% rate cut and payment shift, along with a 5% COLA to get us closer to the rising costs of services to provide to vulnerable citizens on behalf of the state. Each of you are invited to tour our program and visit with clients so that you can witness firsthand why our communities are better off for the services having been provided. We will be back to testify on each of these issues and ask that you advocate on behalf of those we serve this session. Thank you for the opportunity to testify your attention and future consideration.
Thank you. Any questions? I don't see any, so thank you. And who's up next?
My name, sir, is Charlie Oaks.
Okay, good.
And I'm with West Central Industries out of Wilmer, Minnesota. And I'm also representing MNDACA, our trade association. We provide day trading and habilitation services for 16,000 vulnerable citizens in the state of Minnesota. You know who we work with. We work with folks with developmental disabilities, traumatic brain injury, people who just want to be have a normal life and be treated with dignity and respect and haven't made any choices on their own to create the challenges they face. I'm very, very disappointed with the governor's budget, and it's a complicated argument, and I ask you to please bear with me. John mentioned the licensing fee increase. I don't know even know why they're doing it. They haven't given us a reasonable explanation. But I know that for my program, where we have 94 people in our day trading and habilitation program, our current licensing fee is $1,500. The projected new fee is $9,500. That's a 600% increase in 1 year for a license that we, an inspection that we receive every other year that lasts about 4 hours. So that actually works out to, you know, about $4,000 an hour if it's actually going for the licensing inspection. Keep in mind, we're only paid $57.11 a day to take care of the most vulnerable citizens in the state of Minnesota. And that's ours. The rates are different in every program. But our rates have been frozen or cut or surcharged since 2003 to the point where we've lost our purchasing power by 26%. I know my program has cut our budget by 20%. And according to the Department of Human Services' own information, the average direct care service worker that takes care of people for us only makes $8.30 an hour. And these people are not going to be receiving any increase under the governor's budget at this point. In fact, they're going to get a 1.67% cut. And we're going to loan 1/12 of our budget to the state of Minnesota because they're going to shift the payment by a month. Frankly, it's unsustainable. It's simply unsustainable. We are long-term care providers just the same as the nursing homes. It seems only fair that we would be included in any cost of living adjustment that other long-term care organizations get. And then, finally, we have a nuisance issue, this Medicare copay, which is $255 a month per person. It's an accounting nightmare, and it's a piddly little thing that only adds up to a couple of thousand dollars. But when I keep getting my rates cut and I keep getting my fees increased, and then I have a copay that I can't collect from the people that we're serving, and now my understanding is that in the governor's budget that's supposed to go up to $265 instead of $255 a month. I'm talking $2.55, not $250. If we never give our staff raises, they leave. I'm already losing very good people. When we lay off staff, it's horrendous to the morale of the people that are left. Please help us take care of the people that you have put in our care, because they have serious challenges and documented diagnoses. And I don't know if that was 3 minutes or not, but thank you for listening.
Mr. Oaks, do you have an estimate of what your turnover of your employees is?
The last time that was reviewed, it was 50%.
Per year?
Per year. People cannot afford to pay their bills on $8.30 an hour. What they do is they work at the group homes, too, so they don't see their families, and they don't get overtime because it's two different employers. So they end up working 60, 70 hours a week.
Thank you. Any questions? Thank you, Mr. Oaks. And next we have Deb Meyer, licensed practical nurse. Being joined by Sarah Leverance.
With Greater Minnesota AFSCME Council 65, we represent Deb's unit at the Virginia Hospital and Nursing Home, and she's an LPN at the nursing home. Let's talk about the woman who you rehabilitated first. Tell us what happened to her and how she, what they said when she came to your facility and what happened then.
And I want to say this was probably about a year ago. I had a lady admitted who had had a brain aneurysm. When we got her, we were told there was no hope for her, that where she was as far as she was going to advance, that she wasn't able to walk, could barely speak, could not feed herself. So she didn't qualify for any therapy at that time because of them saying that this was it. And because she still had, you know, certain behaviors because of her brain function or lack of, that when we'd place her into bed, she'd roll out. So we ended up placing mats on the floor so that she could roll without harming herself. We put together the room as best we could with what we had, with foam and duct tape to pad the room to make sure she didn't do any further injury to herself. Within time, though, you could tell she was getting a little bit stronger with just the rolling, allowing her to roll on the floor. She was gaining a little bit of strength. So then she was able to get herself up on her hands and knees. Then I would take the time to make her crawl to me. So a couple times it was just a few, you know, few little steps, I guess, it's crawling. But she was, you know, she was able to get stronger. She'd crawl up out into the hallway, which wasn't always an appropriate place to be, but, you know, at least she was getting some strength back. I would also take the time with her at mealtime to make sure she fed herself. And the comment she gave to me when I would tell her she needed to feed herself and make sure she was swallowing her food, she called me the biggest pain in the ass she ever met. And within a few months, she was up and walking. She did qualify to go back and to go into therapy, and we did send her home. But I need to, you know, I have 27 residents that I have to take care of. I need to know that I am allowed that time to take care of these people. That I guess I could have listened to the doctor's diagnosis and just gave her medication and just dealt with it that way. But that's not the kind of nurse I am. I'm also the kind of nurse that when a doctor tells me that there something will not be fixed, I like to prove them wrong.
How did the facility feel about the time you were taking or people in it?
I did have a comment come back to me that because I was trying to get other people, you know, you need to take more time. And I was told that if you want to become a therapist, maybe you need to go to school for that and to do your job. Other people were very supportive. And as they saw her her strength increase and as she was getting better and feeding herself, more staff came on board with trying to improve her.
Tell them about the new kind of patient you're seeing more and more of and that your facility projects that we'll see more of and what it's like to deal with them.
We are getting, I'm going to make this comment, this isn't your mother's or grandmother's or grandfather's nursing home anymore. We are seeing more mentally ill and chemically dependent people admitted to our facility because there's no other placement for them. So we are dealing with behaviors that we have no education or training on how to deal with these people. With the chemically dependent ones, you can deal with the issue of them coming to you and asking for more medication, and when you tell them, nope, this is your order, this is all you get, threatening you to turn you in to the attorney general or the board of nursing because you're not giving them more medication. You know, I have handed them complaint forms. You know, I'm doing my job, this is the order, but it just, you know, it does take away from my other residents that I have to deal with, you know.
Are they violent?
Yes, we have behaviors that are, we get kicked, scratched, pinched, and bit. You know, and lately we've been getting more of that, so trying to, you know, do your job the best you can be quite difficult when you're getting, you know, slapped and cursed at.
What about the night you had to take somebody to the ER?
We had a resident, she had been with us for a few years, and she had a mental illness, and she cycled once in a while, but her mental illness was cycling more often, and she was refusing her medications because she thought we were poisoning her. On this particular night, we needed to send her down to the ER. We are a nursing home that's attached to an ER. To get her onto the gurney, it took four or five staff to lift her on, and while they were trying to get her going, I had to distract her by letting her beat me so she wouldn't go after the other staff so they could transfer her to the gurney.
We're going to have to finish up.
I got two more sentences I want from her.
Would you address the chair?
Mr. Chair, I'm sorry. I apologize profusely.
Ms. Leverance.
How many raises have you had in the last 5 years, and for how much?
I think in the last 5 years we've had one, and it was 2% raise we just got this year.
And the LPNs took a freeze one time. Why?
When we had some monies coming in, the LPNs took the freeze and let the nursing assistants have the extra money because we felt they needed the money because of they're basically the first line of defense when it comes to caring for these residents.
Thank you for your testimony.
Okay.
And next is Jeff Fromm. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Mr. Chair and committee members, I appreciate the opportunity to speak with you here this morning. I bring to you a resolution unanimously adopted recently by our Board of Directors that we, the Board of Directors of Minnesota Faith in Action, endorse the language and the intent of the proposed statute revision 256B.0917 that will implement the goals of Reform 2020, HCBS Critical Access and Services Development. We see this as a major step toward enhancing and expanding home and community-based services for thousands of Minnesotans. Our Faith in Action programs organize volunteers to provide services that help older adults and adults in challenging life situations to remain safely and comfortably in their homes as long as possible. In the past year alone, over 7,000 Faith in Action volunteers throughout the state of Minnesota served over 20,000 people with over 102,000 hours of services ranging from homemaking and chore services to transportation to support for caregivers. Volunteer drivers provided over 70,000 rides, driving over 110,000 miles to doctor appointments, grocery shopping, and for other essential rides. We are all independent, not-for-profit organizations funded primarily by local support from our communities. Though some of our programs have received CSSD funding from time to time, we have never had ongoing funding from the state. Funding our programs has been a challenge at times, yet we have persisted. We're already out there in 2001 when the legislature enacted strategies to reshape long-term care to reduce Minnesota's reliance on nursing homes and increase care for older persons in the community by expanding home and community-based services. We're still out there today. We're all aware of the challenges that will accompany the coming dramatic increase in Minnesota's older population. It will mark a permanent shift in the age of the state population. This will cause extreme pressure on existing long care services. Because the state is a major payer of long-term care, this increase in need for services has the potential to overwhelm the budget, as we all realize. This legislation, which invests in community-level solutions to help people avoid the public safety net, is a response to that challenge. Investing in home and community-based service providers will reduce the pressure on the state systems and allow older Minnesotans and their families more control and responsibility over their care. As the needs of Minnesotans for health and long-term care services will soar in the future, we continue to be there for our people in communities throughout the state. The work that we do is closely aligned with Aging 2030, initiated in 2001 by this Minnesota Department of Human Services in partnership with the Minnesota Board on Aging and the Minnesota Department of Health. We work in partnership with these state organizations, these departments, to ensure the appropriateness and the quality of the services we provide throughout the state. We appreciate that this legislation that is proposed recognizes the work of Minnesota Faith in Action programs throughout the state and makes available on a competitive basis this core funding so that our program leadership can focus much greater attention to actually expanding the services to more people in need. Again, we support this Reform 2020 legislation that is before you, and I thank you for the opportunity to speak today. I'll answer any questions. Or
thank you, Mr. Fromm. Any questions? I don't see any, so thank you very much.
And thank you.
Next we have we have a quorum, so I'll call the meeting to order. And would somebody like to move the minutes from February 5, yesterday?
Mr. Chair, I'd move the minutes.
So the minutes have been moved. Any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? So the minutes are approved. And next we'll go to Ms. Buchner. I'm not sure I pronounced that right. And again, I'd like to remind you, we'd sort of like to keep it to 3 minutes if we can.
We have a slight switch. I'm going to speak instead of Angel, but okay. These two will start.
Okay. So please give your name when you start talking.
My name is Angela Kahn. I'm with the Welfare Rights Committee. And I'd like to thank you, Mr. Chair, and the members of the committee for taking time out to listen to our reaction to the governor's budget proposal. We're an all-volunteer group that has been advocating for 20 years, over 20 years, on behalf of poor and working poor people here in Minnesota. A very disappointing part of the governor's budget proposal is how it fails the poorest families in Minnesota. By not calling for a substantial increase in Minnesota's welfare cash grants. Welfare grants have not been increased since 1986, 27 years ago. Meanwhile, the cost of living has doubled since 1986. A cash grant for a family of two, a parent and a child, is $437 per month, the same as it was in 1986. Again, to keep up with just the cost of living since the last grant increase, the welfare grants should be doubled. For those of you who are new to the committee, welfare, called MFIP, for Minnesota Family Investment Plan, provides cash assistance for families with unemployed parents. You can only qualify for MFIP if there are children in the home. Most people on welfare are children. No one goes to MFIP by choice. Even if the grants were double, most people on welfare would still be homeless. When unemployment insurance runs out, parents are shocked to find out that they don't qualify for welfare because they are not poor enough. Going on MFIP means you have to go deep into a financial hole, and the current grant levels ensure you will stay in that hole for years to come. But for the sake of the kids, families have had to use welfare in tough times. The governor's budget proposal also ignores the millions in cuts to MFIP families over the last several years. And these cuts, in the form of the family cap, housing penalties, sanctions, and lifetime limit, and many others, make life even harder for families in dire need.
Hello, my name is Deb Housie, and I'm with the Minnesota Welfare Rights Committee, and I'll finish the statement. What the government does do about MFIP is a less than a drop in the bucket compared to what is needed. It's tinkering with the earned income discard would only help a very few families. When the grants are so low, they are now. We don't need tinkering. We need dramatic action. Another thing the governor ignores is paying back the TANF funding shift. TANF is the yearly block grant that Minnesota gets from the federal government to fund MFIP. Year after year, TANF dollars have been raided to supplement general fund spending. Right now, if the TANF block grant was used exclusively for poor families, cash grants, it would be almost enough to double the grants. But instead, the money is being used for things that should be paid for, paid for with the general fund dollars. We urge this committee and this body to pass a substantial increase to the MFIP grants. The government budget fails the poorest of the poor. We ask you to urge the House leadership to make budget targets that use TANF money for TANF families. Do the right thing, and for the first time in 27 years, increase the welfare grants.
Could you restate your name, please?
My name is Deborah Housie.
And I just have a few final comments to add. My name is Deborah Konichny. As we just said, the money to increase the grants is there. In 2012, only 27% of the federal TANF block grant given to Minnesota for welfare went to the cash grants for the children and their parents. This means that while Minnesota families have been struggling with homelessness, hunger, and desperate situations, only 27% of the dollars intended for welfare went for their welfare, while 73% of the federal dollars were raided to fund other things. The current welfare grants, as we have said, that have not seen a penny increase for 27 years, actually put families at 70% below the federal poverty level. And as many know, the federal poverty level is no longer a true indicator of poverty. The level of poverty is actually much higher. 70% below the poverty level is considered extreme poverty. And even the DHS in their overview stated that extreme poverty has the most adverse effect on children's health and well-being. This means that tens of thousands of Minnesota children are living in extreme poverty and their well-being is being sacrificed. Even if the welfare grants were doubled, families would still be at 30% below the federal poverty level. Finally, raising the welfare grants is not only the right thing to do, it makes sense. Raising the grants means Minnesota children's health and well-being, education, and potential will dramatically improve overnight. Overnight. There's probably not one other thing we could do that would have such a dramatic impact on children in Minnesota. It's good for Minnesota's economy because families will use the money for needed items and for housing. It puts money back into the economy. Homelessness, hunger, health crises, domestic violence, and poverty cost much more than raising the grants would cost. It will free up more affordable housing. When families currently in subsidized housing have more money, they pay more for the housing, which in turn frees up more dollars for subsidized housing. Currently, only one-third of the families on welfare have access to subsidized housing. And finally, we say that raising the welfare grants will help families get off welfare and into work much faster. Being trapped in extreme poverty puts families in a deep hole that is impossible to get out of. It's nearly impossible to look for work, apply for jobs, if there even are jobs, when we can't keep our phones on, when we're moving from one place to another, when we have no consistent address, when we don't have money for transportation, or when we don't have a shelter. Thank you for the opportunity to testify.
We have a question from Representative Fritz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I did want to comment on the only using of 27% of the TANF funds, and this governor has stated, and I believe him, that he does not want to borrow and shift and tinker with the money that has been used, like the TANF funds and other funds that have been used to pay for other parts of the budget or to balance the budget. So my question is, where did the other money from TANF go if it didn't go to the people it was intended to go to?
Well, I think that's a question more for the DHS. A lot of the money went to programs that are good programs we support, but they supplanted the general fund spending for perhaps child care. There's working family tax credit. There's child welfare, all things that are necessary, but are things that the state should be dedicated to spend money on, not to take money from poor families to fund those programs. And that's what's happened over the years.
Thank you for your honesty and for your response. Mr. Chairman, and on this particular issue and the amount of money out in greater Minnesota, the amount of money that is not available is transportation. You know, we don't have a bus system in the town that I live in. That bus company went broke and closed a number of years ago. So the transportation piece is huge. And I would think that would be almost the whole $400 and some would be a car payment, insurance, and gas and upkeep on a vehicle. That amount of money alone would be necessary to just have transportation in my neck of the woods. I just wanted to make that clear. Thank you.
We say 5, 10, 15, 20, 25, 30 minus 27 is too long. Would you have waited for a paycheck to be raised in that length of time? That's what we say. That's
okay. Could you, when you talk, address the chair, but
I'm
your
sorry.
Time is up. And
thank you.
Thank you.
I'll let you. There's one more here. If you do, keep it very brief, though, because you're way over time.
Chair Huntley, committee members, I'm Phyllis Walker, and I'm here representing Ask Me Local 3800.
Oh, okay, this is the next one.
No, this is, okay.
Okay.
Our president, Shireen Horzak, wanted to be here today to address you, but she's just returning from medical leave, so she asked me to speak to you on her behalf. Our local, Ask Me Local 3800, represents 1,500 clerical workers at the University of Minnesota. Local 3800 is over 90% women, many of whom are single parents, struggling to raise children, and they're barely getting by. If any of our members lost their jobs, they would find that the welfare system in Minnesota does not meet their needs. Ask Me Local 3800 is very proud to see that the governor's budget is designed to reverse many years of economic injustice in Minnesota, but the one thing that it does lack is an increase in the welfare grant. Welfare is a working person's issue. When unemployment insurance runs out, parents who qualify for welfare are shocked to find that the monthly grant is only $437 a month for a family of two, and that it has not been increased since 1986. Welfare is a working person's issue because many of our members are just one job and one paycheck away from being forced to attempt to survive on welfare. Welfare is a working person's issue because welfare sets the floor below which wages cannot fall. Currently, the state of Minnesota allocates 0.1% of its budget to poor children and their families. In these times of high unemployment, it is up to you, our elected officials, to provide a reasonable safety net for the citizens of our state for whom there are no jobs. In our last election, working people spoke out. Their vote told us that they were ready for a change by electing worker-friendly candidates, candidates who are attuned to their needs, not the needs of the wealthy. We ask you to stand with the people who supported you and to partner with our governor to increase the welfare grant in Minnesota. The clerical workers at the University of Minnesota, ASME, Local 3800, stand in support of raising the welfare grant, and we deeply appreciate your support in making an increase in the Minnesota welfare grant a reality. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions? Representative Veblen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And it's not so much a question. I have the same question as Representative Fritz, but we definitely need to find out the answer about where the other money has gone. But I just wanted to thank you for coming and for all of you for continuing to come and give the message that poor children and their parents are not the problem in the state, and to bring forward the message of how poorly we have done by people who need our help, not to stay on welfare. These are not people who want to not work. These are families who very much want to get out of poverty, and I think the message is a really important one, and I certainly hope that, you know, while we're not going to fix everything, I think we're going to do our best to make the lives of these folks better and help them get out of poverty and get on their feet and enjoy the kinds of things that all Minnesotans should enjoy. So thank you very much for your doggedness on this topic.
Next we have Representative Lane.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a quick comment that I want to emphasize that this MFIB program is only a person is only allowed to be on them for 60 months. That's it, for the lifetime. So, and that every single situation for MFIB includes a child, if not more than one. So we create a situation in which we put children into poverty, into extreme poverty, and it's very harmful. We just spent the last few days talking in early childhood on the importance of the brain development for early childhood and how this affects not only their future learning and their future productivity in society, but also their future health. So we pay big time for what we do here, and this is a situation that direly needs our attention.
Representative Gernhagen.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a little bit of an observation. The you know, is there any way, do we get any federal match on these dollars for welfare benefits at all?
Mr. Berg.
Mr. Chair, Representative Gernhagen, the TANF dollars that we're talking about are federal grant dollars, the Temporary Assistance to Needy Families dollars.
And the MFIP?
MFIP is a state program which is funded both by state general fund revenue and by TANF dollars at the federal level.
And, Mr. Chair, just one follow-up comment. Is there any way, and I'm just throwing this out for food for thought, is there any way that the savings that we had Mr. Tariff or Mr. Kerber testify about in terms of fraud or duplicative spend billing and those types of things that they're investigating, if any type of that savings could be applied to the people who really need it in the future? In other words, if they wind up saving $1 million, is that something that could be applied to other programs that actually meet the needs of the people who need it? And I guess that's just something for food for thought as we move along here, unless somebody has a response.
I'm not sure the details of where those recoveries have to go, whether they stay in human services or whether they just go into the general fund. But we can find that out.
May I make one comment?
Would you say that?
Chair
please.
Huntley? I would just say that, just to respond to that, if the TANF dollars, Representative, if all of the federal dollars were used towards cash grants, the cash grants for families could almost be doubled. There's been a funding shift out of TANF. So even if those dollars were actually used for what they were intended for, right now, as I said, it's only 27%. Families, it could dramatically improve people's lives overnight. That's what we're asking for. We're not asking for additional general fund spending, but for the TANF federal dollars to be used for the cash grants.
Representative Grunhagen.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, just, you know, I'm going to give you my card. I'd like to have you meet with my office because I do have some additional questions on that.
Okay.
But, you know, one of the things in my, I'm going to come from a rural area, one of the constant comments or concerns constituents expressed to me is that people who come here, immigrants, and our country is founded on immigrants. It's strengthened by immigrants. But sometimes they're driving around in big SUVs and, you know, and they're receiving benefits. And I just can't figure out how that's all working. And so they point to that as a reason that there's a lot of abuse in the welfare program. And I'm all for helping the people who are in need, okay? But I also want to try to eliminate some of the, if there's fraud or duplication or abuse in the program. And to the degree that you can help us do that, I think we can free up dollars to be able to help you. So, anyway.
Chair Huntley, may I respond to that?
Just briefly.
I would just say that on $437 a month, you can't even afford a bus card. So those individuals most likely are not on welfare. And also I would say the actual amount of fraud of welfare is such a minute percentage that it's not, I don't think there would be much savings from fraud on welfare. You know, so there's a lot of stereotypes out there. A lot of times people think that others are getting benefits and they're not, but $437 a month can't even pay for a house, let alone a bus card or a truck.
Thank you for your
you.
Testimony, and we're going to move on to Ann Kilzer from the Minnesota Workforce Council. And again, if you could keep it down to 3 minutes, we'd really appreciate it.
Mr. Chair and members, thank you for the opportunity. My name is Ann Kilzer, and I'm the director of the Minnesota Workforce Council Association. And I'm here today to applaud the governor's inclusion of funding for work study and paid work experience in his budget proposal. The Workforce Council Association represents Minnesota's workforce boards and the service providers in our workforce centers who deliver the adult, dislocated worker, and youth employment programs. Additionally, most counties contract with these local workforce providers to deliver the employment and training portion of the Minnesota Family Investment Grant Services. Our job counselors work with MFIP participants to develop an employment plan, provide support, assist with job search and placement, and follow up after job placement. They also teach the soft skills needed in the workplace and give referrals to subsidized and unsubsidized work experience. We know that paid work experience is beneficial to our clients. It fully supports our and the governor's efforts to ensure that Minnesota's employers have the skilled workforce needed to meet the demands of our recovering economy. It has been an important tool for employment service counselors to use with MFIP participants who need a structured and monitored work experience to bolster their resumes and their confidence. Paid work experience is useful to keep people focused on the goal of finding employment. It provides participants with opportunities to improve their work skills while building positive work references. The actual funds are used for outreach and recruitment of employers, program orientation and intake of participants, testing and assessment, job development and marketing, pre-worksite training, supported work experience, job coaching, post-placement follow-up, and extensive case management and referral services. Paid work experience funding is a valuable tool for employment counselors to encourage employers to hire MFIP participants that have many roadblocks and challenges that hinder them from successfully competing for jobs in some cases. Barriers like felonies, non-English speaking new immigrants, and poor or limited work history are just a few of those barriers. As I mentioned, the economy is recovering, but as it does, we find that our most vulnerable and difficult to assist clients are the last ones to find opportunities in a still highly competitive employment environment. We have received appropriations for this program in previous budget cycles, and the successful use of this investment can be illustrated by specific examples. I won't take your time to go into all the great stories that we've collected, so I provided a handout with many more. Just one example I'd like to share. A 52-year-old resident of a small rural community in southwest Minnesota was hired to work at the local meatpacking plant. He worked there for less than a year, but due to his fragile and stature and frail health, he couldn't meet the physical demands of the work and was enrolled in the MFIP program. While on MFIP, he began job searching with the Employment and Training Office. With the help of paid work experience money, the job counselor placed him with a dairy farmer for an on-the-job training contract. At first, this MFIT participant did not fully understand the job duties of milking cows, and he could not figure out the steps required to milk the cows correctly, which was frustrating to his employer. But thanks to the on-the-job training contract, the employment counselor from the Workforce Center was able to work with the employer, and they could both see that this 52-year-old man really wanted to work and was trying his best. The employer decided to give the participant another chance and created a new job for him cleaning stalls and bottle feeding the baby calves. This training contract allowed the employment counselor to work hand-in-hand with the client, and the employer gave this man a chance at employment outside of the packing house, which is one of the few employers in some rural Minnesota communities who hire very low-skilled workers. Typically, this employer would not have been willing to sacrifice his time and resources training someone for this entry-level job. Not only did the program open the door for the MFIP customer, but now this employer appreciates the hard work and ethics of this employee and has been willing to invest in hiring other low-skilled workers. Without workforce experience funding, it is nearly impossible to do on-the-job training contracts with employers. The regular grants can't be stretched to cover this amazing opportunity for our MFIP clients. It's hard to encourage an employer to just hire an MFIP participant because we'd like them to, when many cases, some have more barriers and challenges than someone who has a more extensive work history, no criminal history, or can fluently speak or read English. Furthermore, many employers are hesitant to take a chance on a new hire in this still tenuous economic environment. These training dollars offer the carrot and take away some of the cost and extra burden of training, making it less of a risk for employers to take a chance on these folks who really do want to work, but sometimes have a hard time finding a job or an employer willing to give them a chance.
Could you finish up?
Yep. My final sentence, actually, Mr. Chair, thank you. We encourage you to follow the governor's lead and invest in this very worthy program. Thank you.
Thank you. Question? I don't see any.
Thank you.
Next, we'll go to Ann Henry. Again, if you could keep it 3 minutes, I'd appreciate it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I will try. I have a handout, so I can skip some of what I was going to say. First of all, thank you for the opportunity. My name is Ann Henry, and I'm with the Minnesota Disability Law Center at Legal Aid. We represent people with long-term permanent disabilities, intellectual developmental disabilities, brain injury, mental illnesses, physical disabilities across Minnesota. We support many of the items in the governor's budget, and we look forward to working with you and staff once the language becomes available. And in my handout, you'll see five items. I'll tick them off in 10 seconds, but then I'd like to move to four items on which we have concerns. We support the basic rate increases for MA providers in fee-for-service, especially dentists and rehab providers. We support the statewide common entry point for vulnerable adult complaints. We've supported this for over 15 years. We're happy to see it. We support a lot of the quality initiatives for home and community services, especially training to move to positive behavior supports instead of aversive practices and restraint and seclusion. We support many of the mental health provisions, especially the school-linked mental health and others. And finally, we support a lot of what's in the Reform 2020, and in particular, the effort to reform Personal Care Assistance Services, PCA. You're going to be familiar with a new acronym this session because the term PCA is going to change, at least that's the proposal, to Community First Services and Supports, CFSS. And we support this. It's a reform and modernization of the program. Now to the four items on which we have concerns. First of all, community service providers are facing a 1.67% rate cut when they actually need a rate increase. We do see increases for the nursing facilities. Community providers desperately need an increase as well. We've got to have staff in these programs that can actually earn a living. The second area that we strongly support but also have concerns is the expansion of Medicaid to 138% of the poverty level, along with the Minnesota Care / Basic Health Plan waiver proposal. Taken together, those two offer what I think could be a dramatic change in national disability policy. And here's why. At this point, if you're graduating from school and have a disability and need, for instance, personal care assistance services, you're told you need Medicaid, and in order to get Medicaid, you have to go to Social Security and declare yourself totally and permanently disabled, unable to work anywhere in the national economy. And this is what young people are told just after they've gone through school and are ready to go and get a job. So the opportunity to get Medicaid, if we have the right benefits, and same in Minnesota Care, such as PCA services, without having to go down that disability path is tremendous. We think especially younger people would be able to be employed and be far more independent than we set people on a path to do today. So that is terrific. However, we need to point out some business undone in the ACA. If you remember the charts that Assistant Commissioner Scott Wright showed you on all the Medicaid groups and their income standards, people with disabilities and seniors are at the bottom, and there's no change for them. They're stuck at 100% of the poverty level, and if they have $1 over 100%, they have to spend down to 75% of the poverty level. And these are people, many of them, that we expect to live independently. They rent in the same markets, go to the same grocery stores. So we urge that that group also be brought up to 138% of the poverty level. And for people living independently, they should also not have an asset test like everyone else on Medicaid. The third item that we support and have concerns about is a proposal for children with autism. We're very anxious for details, and we are very happy about the investment of $12 million. But we think there's another area that needs attention at the Department of Human Services, and that is accountability of managed care plans who provide services for our low-income children in PMAP, prepaid medical assistance. We believe that we need a lot more transparency. How many kids are getting early screening at 18 months, getting identified, and what type of intervention are they getting? So that these low-income children, many from immigrant communities and communities of color, also can improve by the time they reach school. So we'll be working to see that those provisions are included.
Ms. Henry, can you wrap it up?
Finally, the transition from Anoka to Minnesota Security Hospital. We support the extra money, and we think there's more the state can do, and stay tuned for that. Thank you.
Questions? I don't see any. So thank you for your testimony. And next is Bruce Nelson. And I'll again remind folks that 3 minutes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I am Bruce Nelson with ARM, and my mantra is 3 minutes. I represent or work for ARM. We're an association of about 140 providers of services to people with disabilities in the various CADI, CAC, BI, DD, waivers, ICFMR. We employ collectively about 30,000 caregivers. I'm going to focus, there are many things in the budget we like, but I'm going to focus on some things we're missed or have concern. First off, as been mentioned earlier, the budget is inconsistent in terms of providing much needed rate increases, or in our case, rate increases and wage enhancement for various services. Our caregivers, about 30,000 of them, haven't seen an increase, many of them, for 4 years. I want you to keep in mind that 97% of the money we get is from government, and therefore there's no other revenue stream we can shift to. A cut is a cut. There's questions about turnover. It's about 40% to 50% each time a year. Each time there's a turnover, it costs about $2,500. Also, in terms of inconsistency, state caregivers who do precisely the same thing as our people in the private sector will be getting a 2% increase. There is a provision in the bill or in the budget for pay for performance. That would be a quality add-on and a process yet to be determined in the following biennium. But I want to say one thing about quality. And without a stable workforce of caregivers, there is no policy you can invent or create or make up that will produce quality care for vulnerable people. You have to have a quality workforce, and that's driven by how much they can make and take care of their families. The 1.67, we start in a hole with that cut. We think that's inappropriate. Licensing fees, as you've heard, go up. We would like to see what the state is buying. Keep in mind, when we pay fees, that's the same as a cut because it comes out of the same money and it cuts back on services. I don't know how I'm doing on my mantra, Mr. Chair, but one more thing, and that's, you've heard before, the family copay of $2.55 we would like to see addressed as well. I apologize for talking so fast, but if there are any questions, I stand ready.
I appreciate your talking fast, and Representative Schumacher.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Nelson, last year we worked as a legislature to produce some reforms that were cost-saving reforms to the industry that you're working. Is that correct? And how has that been influenced in our budget, as far as you know, over the last few months?
Mr. Chair, Representative Schumacher, you're right, and thank you for working and carrying that legislation and working so closely with us, and Representative Abler and many others of you on both sides of the aisle. The upshot is, at this point, most of the reforms that were adopted last year on a bipartisan basis have not been implemented by the department yet, or have yet to go to CMS for permission to do. So we are seeing some of our members on their own moving towards closure of corporate foster care beds. We're concerned that they're not being booked toward a goal of 128, and if we don't achieve that goal, there would be forced closure. So we know the department is very busy in a lot of things, and we support a lot of those things, but we are also very concerned that we're not moving ahead with those reforms.
And just a follow-up, Mr. Chair, I just want to...
Representative Schumacher.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to thank Mr. Nelson and the industry for, even though they have had, as testimony was, a low rate for what they've been getting, they have been looking for ways to lower their cost and reform the industry so that they can save the state money, even at a time when they're having a lot of difficulty in getting the funds that they need. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, thank you for recognizing that, Representative Schumacher. We do try to bring solutions as well as having our hand out.
Well, thank you, Mr. Nelson. Next we have Anna Youngerman from Children's Hospitals and Clinics, and welcome back to the House of Representatives.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Thank you for the opportunity to be here. My name is Anna Youngerman. I'm the Director of Policy and Advocacy at Children's Hospitals and Clinics of Minnesota. As an organization whose mission is to champion the special health needs of children, we're pleased that the governor's budget prioritizes children's health and health care. I want to call attention very briefly to just a few of those priorities. First, Merck. We're pleased that the governor's funding for the medical education and research cost, or Merck, program. In 2011, Children's trained over 400 residents and fellows in general pediatrics and pediatric subspecialties such as cardiac surgery, neurology, and neonatology. As a result of the 50% cut to Merck funding in 2011, we were forced to eliminate several of our training programs. As the state's leading pediatric training facility, restoration of Merck funding is critical to maintaining a medical workforce that can respond to the unique healthcare needs of children across the state. Second, the governor's budget documents reference the widening gap between medical costs and MA reimbursement rates. As an organization that receives 42% of our revenue from Medicaid, which compares to about 5 to 10% of our at our adult counterpart systems, we're acutely aware of this imbalance. In 2011, we experienced a $57 million gap between costs and reimbursement. While the proposed rate increases in the governor's budget won't come close to filling that gap, we appreciate the step forward, and it helps us in balancing our commitment to serving kids regardless of their ability to pay and continuing to provide innovative, high-quality care. Then I'll just quickly reference a few other provisions in the budget that we support. We're glad to see some financial support for care coordination. Children's had the state's first certified medical home, and so we've seen the benefit of care coordination. Unfortunately, as we all know, payment has not kept up with that new way of delivering care. So any efforts to move toward a payment model that rewards outcomes rather than services is welcome. We appreciate the number of funding and program provisions directed toward children's behavioral and mental health. This is an area we all recognize as being an unmet need. As the state's leading pediatric provider of oncology care, we're grateful to see the continuation of emergency medical assistant coverage for cancer treatment. We support the renewed focus on population health efforts through the investment in the SHIP program. And lastly, while it's perhaps a little bit outside of this committee's purview, we are supportive of the governor's effort to increase the tobacco tax. And in fact, because of the proven benefit to preventing kids from smoking, we would encourage the legislature to look at a $1.50 per pack increase. And that's all I've got.
Okay, thank you. Any questions for Ms. Younger? I don't see any, so thank you for your testimony. Next, we have Rick Varco from SEIU.
Chairman Huntley, members of the committee, my name is Rick Varco. I'm the political director with SEIU Healthcare Minnesota. We represent about 15,000 healthcare workers around the state in hospitals, clinics, and nursing homes. For years, our members have faced a seemingly endless round of tight budgets. Throughout it all, our members have rolled up their sleeves and tried to work with our employers to do more with less. I would like to say we've always been successful at finding efficiencies, but far too often cuts at the legislature have resulted in real harm to real people. It's not uncommon for our members to sit across the table from an employer waving a newspaper headline with the latest set of budget cuts from the legislature. Those headlines have led to major layoffs at big hospitals, a rash of nursing home closures, and widespread cuts in hours worked. This is a much more pleasant budget. I'd like to say we strongly support the full expansion of Medicaid in Minnesota. The wisdom of Medicaid expansion has been recognized by a growing bipartisan group of governors, including most recently Governor Kasich in Ohio. We're very encouraged that DHS has set aside funds to continue Minnesota care while seeking federal funds to continue it as a BHP option within the ACA. Moving this population into the exchange would actually be a move backwards, and we should try to avoid that. SEIU applauds Governor Dayton for proposing a renewed commitment to home and community-based services in his budget through Reform 2020. The new Community First Service and Supports programs will make good on the promise of the Community First Choices Act, a part of the Affordable Care Act that we worked really hard for. By providing more choices and helping people stay in their homes, Reform 2020 will save taxpayers $151 million over 5 years. I would echo Ms. Youngerman's comments on the cigarette tax and just add from personal experience, I smoked 5 years in Georgia and 5 years in Minnesota. It was much harder to quit in Georgia, where the cigarette taxes were far lower. And then we would... Two short comments. We would like to thank Governor Dayton for including a modest increase in funding for Minnesota nursing homes. While we're still looking at the details, it looks like he's provided a 2% annual increase in non-property rates, paid both as a fixed across-the-board increase and a variable quality bonus. We encourage the legislature to include language dedicating a portion of the increase towards frontline caregivers. Such language has been included in every non-property rate increase since the late 90s. While we appreciate the governor's proposed increase, we think a larger increase is needed to make up for years of neglect. SEIU, along with other long-term care unions, senior groups, and the Long-Term Care Imperative, will be supporting a bill from Representative Patty Fritz to provide a 5% increase. I just end by noting that since the late 90s, I think every legislature has modified the governor's nursing home budget upwards. We encourage you to continue this honorable and bipartisan tradition. Thank you.
Representative Mack has the question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Varco,
Just a brief question. You cited in your testimony a large number of layoffs and linked that to reductions in the past several years. Wondering if you have either with you or could provide where those layoffs were, how they were directly linked to budget cuts and things of that nature. If those were SEIU members, I'm just looking for a citation or links to that exact information.
Mr. Verko.
I don't have a list of the layoffs. I know there were major layoffs at North Memorial. I know Fairview did a major round of layoffs. I can't give you the breakdown of how many were union and non-union. And with anything in healthcare funding, it's always hard to sort of track. You know, there was this set of cuts that led to this specific thing because there's so much cost shifting going on. I can tell you, though, that when, you know, we talk to employers about layoffs, one of the things they frequently mention is what happens at the legislature.
We can probably find that from the providers, but I think that's a very good question. If you have a follow-up?
No, Mr. Chair, not necessarily, just echoing what you said. Any specific information that you could provide and delineating how that all relates would be very helpful.
Mr. Chair, and I apologize for not referencing you first previously. Representative Mack, I will try to get some information for you.
Other questions? Don't see any, so thank you for your testimony. Next is Mary Reagan. Reagan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is Mary Reagan. I'm the executive director of the Minnesota Council of Child Caring Agencies, which is a statewide association of providers of services for children and adolescents. We have 46 organizations that provide over 300 programs for children and their families around the state. I'd like to begin by just noting that we appreciate the governor's support for increased revenue that makes some of the things that I want to talk about today possible. But I will begin with some of the things we're not as excited about. And one is disappointment that there wasn't any more appropriation for the Homeless Youth Act, which I think, as you know, has been woefully underfunded since it passed in 2007. Unaccompanied homeless youth between the ages of 16 and 21 is the fastest growing population of homeless people in Minnesota. We have 108 beds to shelter between 2,000 and 2,500 young people who are homeless every night in Minnesota. We also have some concerns about the proposal called North Star Care for Children. We completely support the increase in rates for relatives and adoptive parents that's contained in this proposal. Some of you may know this proposal has been around. This is the third time it has come back. And every time it's gotten a little better. And we really believe that increasing the rates, especially for relatives and for foster parents who make the decision to adopt the children in their care, could make a difference in permanency outcomes for children. Unfortunately, the proposal pays for this increase in rates in part by decreasing the support for 500 of the highest needs children in foster care. And it is difficult for us to support a proposal that takes from one set of vulnerable children to try and support another. So we strongly encourage you to find another way, and we're committed to working with the department to target this increase or find other funds so that this could be done right without hurting some children in order to help others.
Okay, well, let me make a comment first. Just yesterday I talked to a person representing Catholic Charities, and I probably had five other discussions so far this year with people very interested in the homeless youth thing, and I would suggest that you get together with them, because you've all heard me say we're all overwhelmed with information. If you could coordinate your activities with that group as a unit, it would be a lot easier for us to understand the issue. So, Representative Fisher.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One of the things that I'd like to ask our testifier is, she was referencing the Homeless Youth Act. Right now, each year, approximately how much money is the state spending for the 2,500 youth?
Mr. Regan.
Mr. Chair. Right now, the appropriation is $238,000 for the biennium.
So comes out to just a little over, what, about $109,000, $110,000 a year?
Correct.
So if we've got 2,500 youth who are homeless on any given day, like on today when it's very cold out tonight, we're spending about 13 cents a day per youth then, would be what I would come out with the calculation. So if you want to get an idea of what's going on, that kind of gives you a little bit of idea. This is only a very small drop in the bucket.
Thank you. Other questions? Representative Liebling.
Well, thanks. Well, first I have just a comment. Boy, Representative Fisher, either you're prepared or you're really quick with the math. I just wanted to ask Ms. Regan about, you made the comment about the 500 foster children whose needs will be met less well because of under this proposal, and could you just explain that a little bit? I mean, I understand there's a fixed appropriation that's being used differently, but just give us a little more sense of who those 500 are that you're talking about and what needs are we talking about not meeting under this proposal, if you would.
Mr. Chair, Representative Liebling, thank you for the question. Well, it's tricky. The rates for foster care are set in one system right now, and there's a base rate that's paid to any foster family based on the age of the child. And then there is a difficulty of care assessment that sets additional funding based on the needs of that particular child and the activity of the foster parents. Relative care assistance and adoption assistance are under a separate track. Those basic rates are about 50% of what's paid to foster parents, and the gap has been growing every year. They have some difficulty of care rate that's also added, but again, it's about 50% of what is available to foster parents. Our foster care system in Minnesota returns about 85% of the children that it serves to their families. Family reunification is the first thing that happens or is attempted. We have about 350 children in Minnesota who are awaiting adoption, and about another 450 to 500 who are at risk of aging out of care without any permanent connection. So that's that population. The 500, the estimated 500 foster children who would see a reduction in their support is based on what's available today under the current foster care difficulty of care assessment versus what would be available under the governor's proposal, which is a reduction of anywhere between $400 and $600 a month to those foster families caring for these highest needs children. We don't know in a comprehensive way what the characteristics of those children are, other than that they meet that highest assessment need based on their care needs today.
Thank you, Mr. Okay, we're going to have to move on, so thank you for your testimony. And next we have Ari Thurlow and Toby Pearson. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, members, my name is Toby Pearson with Care Providers of Minnesota. Testifying with our partners, Aging Services, together our advocacy is under the umbrella of the long-term care imperative here at the Capitol. Minnesota's nursing homes and assisted living providers contribute over 112,000 jobs to the economy. That's a $6.7 billion statistic. On average, about 70% of those providers' budgets go to wages and benefits for their employees. Our membership's reaction to the governor's proposed funding increase for skilled nursing facilities was mixed. We'd like to thank the governor for the acknowledgement in the budget for the first time in the last 10 years. That's very nice that we were included. However, we do need to clarify that this proposal is, in a sense, budget neutral. There was an increase to property and operating rates that was shifted to pay for the increase. So, in essence, took from property and operating, moved it to the other side. I'd like to state that we do have concerns regarding the increase being tied to current quality measures. We feel strongly that we need to craft quality or performance measures that do not punish providers with backward-looking report card approaches, but instead like to see an approach that will incent people to improve from where they are today. This is a stronger approach that serves as a carrot for providers and allows everybody to take positive, proactive steps towards improvement. We need to seriously examine the overall funding and how much of that increase should be based in relationship to this quality improvement. As one of our members said to us, a 1% increase with another 1% tied to quality does not begin to cover the gap that has developed between our Medicaid costs and allowable charges. That gap is over $27 a day, per person, per day. You can't make it up in volume. To put the proposal in perspective, we have reports that the average hourly wage paid to a nursing assistant is around $11 an hour. That means, as one of our members said to us, this is an increase of 12 cents an hour for that person. We hear reports of staff turnover rates exceeding 50%. We hear reports of massive loss of staff when a new Menards opens up and starts hiring staff away. The turnover and loss of staff impacts seniors who are receiving these services. With the economic times that we have lived through since 2008 and the large state budget deficits, we recognize that you have a very big job. But you need to know that you have an enormous amount of control over the financial stability of Minnesota's nursing facilities. 82% of the money coming into a nursing home is controlled by Medicaid rate, and their needs have been ignored for far too long. In essence, investments in senior services are investments in caregivers and the seniors they serve. Now I'll turn it over to Ms. Thurlow to discuss the issues with the elderly waiver.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Carrie Thurlow. I'm the Vice President of Advocacy for Aging Services of Minnesota and also appearing here today on behalf of the Long-Term Care Imperative. And as Mr. Pearson indicated, I'll focus my comments primarily on the Elderly Waiver Program, which is actually the largest program providing senior care services for Minnesota seniors. I know you've heard a lot of testimony today, and I don't pretend know what that's like sitting in your places to listen to all this testimony. So I'm going to boil it down to you, for you, and hope you take away one thing from my comments today, and that's that we can't say that a budget is supporting seniors and their caregivers if it only helps out the nursing homes in Minnesota. You also have to help out the elderly waiver program to fully address the needs of seniors and their caregivers. The elderly waiver program is the program that funds home and community-based services for Minnesota seniors. These are individuals that qualify for nursing facility level of care, but they're choosing to receive their services outside a nursing facility. We currently serve over 22,000 seniors through the Elderly Waiver Program, and that's compared with just over 17,000 individuals in nursing homes. Not only are we serving a lot of seniors there, but we're actually saving a lot of money. The Elderly Waiver Program is extremely cost-effective, which is one of the reasons why we have it. We can serve seniors, about three seniors on the Elderly Waiver Program for every one senior in nursing homes. Now, please do not take my comments to indicate that we shouldn't be supporting nursing homes. They have an important role. But you also need to understand that the Elderly Waiver Program is important. Unfortunately, Governor Dayton's budget does not include any increases to this program at all, despite the fact that the Elderly Waiver Program has been cut by double digits in the last 4 years. Moreover, the governor does leave in place another cut that will take effect on July 1st of this year, if the legislature and lawmakers do not act, of an additional 1.67%. When I talk to our members about the impact of the chronic underfunding and cuts to the Elderly Waiver Program, I talk to a provider from Elk River, who runs a nonprofit assisted living setting out in Elk River. And she talked about one of her clients, Resident M, who is aging in place. She's lived there for 5 years, and her needs are getting more complex. She needs more help. And yet the budget for her needs, the budget for the Elderly Waiver Program is allocated on a per-client basis, has actually gone down. Now, this provider continues to serve that resident because she meets her mission. But if you were in her place, think about the options that she's facing. Continue to serve that client at a loss. Have that client move to a different provider to serve that client at a loss. Or transfer that client to a nursing home, which is the entitlement, at a higher cost to the state. It simply is a problem that needs to be addressed. Now, the governor does...
If you could
Absolutely, Mr. Chair. We would say that we look forward to this conversation because we know that there's a lot of support on a bipartisan basis to support home and community-based services for seniors, and we look forward to the continued conversation about the nursing or about the home and community-based report card and the small performance payments that are in the budget for across all waivers. And so we look forward to that conversation.
Yeah, Ms. Thurlow, if you could remind me sometime in the next couple of weeks to ask Mr. Hoffman if he could give me an estimate of the cost of moving people out of elderly waivers into nursing homes, what the effect would be on the state budget.
Absolutely, Mr. Chair, we can get you that data.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Ms. Thurlow, what I would really like, you just gave an example of somebody who's being served and the costs aren't keeping up. I'd like the specifics of that example. How much is being paid? How much are, what are the costs? What are the services? Could you do that for me on that example that you've given? Anonymously, of course. But just, I really want to know the details of that situation.
Mr. Chair, Representative Liebling, I'm happy to go back to that provider and see what information I can get and certainly try to connect and see if we can get those specific details. Happy to do that for you.
Okay, let's go on. And next is Alex Fitzsimmons, who just walked in here about 2 minutes ago. And, yeah, the next people after her would be Lynn Nelson and then Eric Hogg. Welcome to committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I just need a couple seconds here to set up my little friends. Be quick. Okay. So thank you. My name is Alexandra Fitzsimmons, and I'm the Legislative Affairs and Advocacy Director for Children's Defense Fund Minnesota. In addition to research, outreach, and youth development work, we help develop public policies and advocate for policies that seek to improve the well-being of children and strengthen the stability of families. So that being said, I will briefly touch upon a couple key issues with the governor's proposed budget, and first want to say that we're supportive of many of the pieces in his budget, especially the pieces focusing on children with the statewide expansion of PSAP, looking at improving child care rates in an effort to increase access, also access to mental health services, looking at sleep practices for infants. So very supportive of those pieces, and also supportive of Governor Dayton's efforts to rework or rebuild the MFIT program. And that's where my brief comments will be in response to. So with that, first want to provide a framework, and that when we go to the Department of Human Services and look at their mission, that their mission says that their work is to help people meet basic needs so they live in dignity and achieve the highest potential. And underneath that, they identify the values that they're working to achieve. And the first value outlined in the mission of DHS is to focus on people and not the programs. So my brief testimony will focus on the people in MFIP, not the programs. And that brings us to these 10 little figures here that as we look at, and I see my adults have separated out here. If we look at MFIP and we have 100,000 Minnesotans who are receiving assistance each month, we know that 70%, 7 out of 10, are children. And so the message, the prime message that I bring to you today is that as we work to rebuild and rework MFIP, that we bring this focus, this child focus, to a program that serves so many of our children. And in way of numbers, 70,000 children receive MFIP assistance each month, and half, 35 or 36,000, are age 5 or under. And I know this committee knows full well the importance of brain development and the relationship between experiences that are happening in early childhood and how some of the experiences that many of our children who are receiving MFIP are facing can actually impede their brain development. But that's not where the piece starts, and I will get to my specifics at what we're looking at, and I will be brief. But just along those lines, that the end of the story is not that our children are facing some extreme adversity. It's that we know what to do, and that early intervention works, and that we know where many of our children are in the system now, and so can we look at ways that we can be smarter with MFIP, so continuing to work with you and DHS to look at how we bring that child focus. So on that piece, I just want to point out two other pieces that look at the well-being of children who are receiving MFIP. We know, and first of all, we have very little data on children who are receiving MFIP, but what we do know is that one-third of MFIP children and MFIP families are enrolled in special ed. And that's important, again, with the relationship between early intervention and special ed, because we know from a study that was done at the University of Minnesota back in 2009 that children who received early intervention services who were followed over time, a third of them did not need special education by second or third grade. And the second fact that I want to leave you with today, too, is that nearly two-thirds of young children who were tested in an MFIP pilot, and the report came out in 2010 on mental health services, that two-thirds of the young children screened positive for potential developmental delay. So that being said, what we'd like to look at as you are considering ways to reform MFIP, we want to look at child outcomes. So not just looking at the role of mom or dad as worker, but mom or dad as parent. So to look at that piece and to look at the outcome piece of how we know our children are doing, and to have that included as one of the outcomes within MFIP. Two would be to make certain that parents have information on early childhood development and resources that are available. Third would be to be looking at child care and making certain that children who are in child-only cases, that they would also have some child care that would be available to them if they don't have any other early childhood experiences. Looking at connecting our systems, so not having the siloed approach where we think about MFIP just as within DHS, but we look at, again, that cross piece. How is it impacting education? How is it impacting health? To have a way of looking at that within MFIP. Fourth would be to repeal the family cap. We have to repeal the family cap. And I know that you've heard testimony about that, and I know I'm sure all of you have heard from my colleague Jessica Webster on that as well, so I won't go further into that, but just to say that that's one of the things that we need to do. And then also along the same lines is that we need to increase the amount of assistance that families are receiving. It's not enough. It's not enough to meet the needs of children, especially when we look at disparities that are growing between families with lower incomes and families with higher incomes, and looking at educational outcomes. Lastly, looking at some efforts to count as work activity, parents' involvement with early childhood activities. So again, to raise the role of worker, and actually to raise the role of parent as to the same, at least the same as role of worker. So I look forward to working with all of you as we look at how we're going to rework MFIP. And I thank you very much, and am always open for any questions. So thank you for your time.
Yeah, thank you for your testimony, and next we had Lynn Nelson, but she's graciously offered to come back tomorrow. And then we had Steve Larson and Kurt Rutzen, and they've also offered to come back tomorrow. So the last testifier for today, and I apologize to the people that are, we'll have to come back tomorrow, but Eric Haugie of AFSCME.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members, and thanks for giving me the opportunity to testify today. My name is Eric Haugie with AFSCME Council 5, and I want to thank the committee for the opportunity to give input today on the governor's budget. AFSCME Council 5 represents more than 43,000 employees across the state, and it's no exaggeration when I say that most of this budget affects our members, whether it's the people working in DHS central offices in St. Paul who administer these programs, or county social workers who help people sign up and maneuver public assistance programs, or the frontline LPNs in private nursing homes, hospitals, and state-run facilities. And many of our seasonal and part-time employees and their families use programs like Minnesota Care because they can't get affordable health care through their employer. In the audience today are some of the staff who work in state-operated service facilities if members have specific questions about their work. These public programs and services provide the safety net for the hardest to serve Minnesotans, and for years we've seen them eroded. So it's also no exaggeration when I say this is by far one of the best budgets to come out of an administration in many years. Given the breadth of the impact on our members, I'll try to focus on a few key proposals today. First, we wholeheartedly endorse the governor's proposal to expand medical assistance to serve more families, and we look forward to working on efforts to continue Minnesota Care with the creation of a basic health plan. We like the financing changes and savings realized in several of the Reform 2020 proposals, and we'll be watching closely how they are implemented, especially at the county level, but also making sure that as Minnesota does more to help keep people in their homes and in less restrictive community settings, the staff at the facilities are engaged and a central part of the transition initiatives. Next, we're pleased to see long-term care make a noteworthy appearance in the budget, and we hope the proposed rate increase is but a starting point. Counties naturally play an important role in the delivery of human services, and ensuring this is done in a thoughtful, integrated manner with the funding necessary to provide services is important to AFSCME Council 5. Finally, we appreciate the governor's investment in child care in this budget. It's great to see the support for increased reimbursement rates and system changes aligned with parent aware. And while we look forward to a more robust discussion on the child mortality legislative proposals, we think the solution lies in engaging providers, licensors, and parents about child safety and safe sleep. Training should be affordable, accessible, and relevant, and when possible, designed with providers. Specific to the jurisdiction of this committee, resources to offset the costs of required professional development and training, as the governor has provided in this budget, are needed and should be a central part of the discussion. Thanks for the opportunity to testify, and we look forward to working with you this session.
Questions? I don't see any, so thank you, Mr. Howdy, and that will finish the meeting for today, so the meeting is adjourned.